This is, of course, the first Sunday service of the new year. And even though these time markers are, in a sense, only man-made, especially since January 1st doesn't really have an astrological or an astronomical meaning, it's just a man-made moment in time. It's neither a solstice nor an equinox nor anything like that. It's just here we are. But the fact of the matter is, there is a kind of collective power in the concept of new beginnings. And it's definitely something that we as human beings seem to need, because our progress is seldom an uninterrupted, glorious streaking from where we are toward the peak of the mountain. There tends to be a lot of hills and valleys and moments when we go splat that characterize our progress, and we have to often find a way to renew our commitment and often to put behind us. I'm always struck by this first affirmation of the year, which is on success. It's a very good affirmation, and it says, I leave behind me both my failures and my accomplishments. And it's an interesting thought. We tend to be very tuned into the fact that those realities that have not worked out for us, that have caused us to be disappointed or embarrassed or dismayed, whatever they might be, we have a very strong sense that we need to not dwell on those because they definitely pull our energy down. But the interesting addition that Swamiji adds to this is that we also have to forget our past successes, not in the sense of not feeling confident in our future successes, but not allowing ourselves simply to sit there and feel that we've reached the goal because of look at all the things that we've done. Limiting ourselves, in other words, to our present accomplishments, or letting just that the basking and resting on those laurels, so to speak, be a lack of incentive for the future. There are so many things that are part and parcel of this path, so many fundamental teachings that a person can learn in their first even few months of being on this path. So many different instructions and ideas that Master has given us. In fact, Yogananda himself said, if you do only 10% of what I ask you to do, he said, you'll make great spiritual progress. And then he said, the difficulty is everybody does a different 10%. And that's why he has to offer so many choices. So very often through the years of spiritual progress, or through the months or the weeks, depending on how you are and your own evolution in this, different aspects of it will suddenly sort of vividly come to your mind as being something you should concentrate on now. Just one little facet for those who are disciples, we have a whole line of gurus. People tend to form their first relationship with one or another of the masters, often Yogananda, or you may come in here with a close relationship with Jesus or Babaji. And then there's always this thought lurking that there's this whole line of masters. I remember at one point, I lived alone at that time, this was in the early 70s, and my bed was under a sort of window ledge, and on that window ledge I had a photograph of each of the masters in a frame. And one time in the middle of the night, for no reason at all that I can imagine, the photo of Babaji flipped off the wall and landed upright right on my chest, which I was not dumb enough to not understand. I thought, well, maybe there's something in this for me. And I began to just communicate more, think more about Babaji for a time, until over the days and weeks he became more real to me. Swami Kriyananda tells the story of giving a talk at a bookstore, I think it was the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles, and they have pictures of a lot of great saints and masters up on the walls there. And Swamiji's subject was finding your spiritual path. And he was saying, you don't have to be anxious about this. When the time is right, when the disciple is ready, the guru will come to you. And right at that moment, a man who was sitting in the back, he hadn't realized he was sitting under a portrait of Satya Sai Baba. And again, the picture came off the wall, flipped over, and landed upright in the man's lap. And to make it more so, he had been trying to decide whether or not to go to India to see Satya Sai Baba. And he just sort of looked at the picture, and then for the rest of the talk, he was clutching it to his chest like that. Swami Kriyananda tells the story of feeling compelled by some inner power when he was in New York City in 1948. He had glimpsed Autobiography of a Yogi. He'd seen Autobiography of a Yogi on a bookshelf. but had neglected to buy it at that time. But then he was just walking down the street, planning to go one direction, and he felt himself turned by an invisible force to go back. And the thought of that book was so strongly in his mind. And it has the portrait, actually, the portrait of Yogananda, which is right here, right on the cover. And Swamiji, he said he just took the book like that and sort of held it to his chest with this sudden sensation that he and this yogi, about whom he knew nothing, were old friends. And then he describes, you know, this is the most critical point of his spiritual search. He meets in the bookstore a high school friend of his who's now graduated college. And this friend is going to go into the advertising business. He's going to go onto Madison Avenue and he's going to make a real killing in the advertising business. And that's where the future is. And if you're wise, Don, which was his name, you'll go into the advertising business too. And Swamiji said, the more this man talked, Swami Holding, Autobiography of a Yogi, which he hasn't read even at this point, he said the more he felt that he and this strange yogi, as he put it, were allies, and that this whole world that he had lived in up until this point was the strange world, and that it was to Yogananda's world that he belonged. Now, how do we explain realities like this? The only thing we can say, and we have to say, and all evidence points to it, is that what we think of as ourselves is just the thinnest veneer over the power and the energy that's really happening. And I think the focus point, if we want to take it now for this coming year, which may be a year of great change, we'll have to see what happens, is that we want to really pick our lives up by the right string. I was extremely gratified to read in the paper, I think it was on New Year's Day or maybe January 2nd, I've enjoyed the fact now, I'm going to put about four phrases here, I'm going to back all the way up to here. You know, living as I have now for almost 40 years in the context of Ananda, and for a great deal of that time, in one way or another, I've had what I consider to be the extraordinary privilege of speaking to people, not only those who have been on the path as long as I or longer, but many people who are new, and trying to bring these ideas that Yogananda brought, that Swami articulated so beautifully, that have been lived in these Ananda communities, you know, to the awareness of people who may not have thought of them, and then even more than that, to make them attractive. Not for any sense of it's up to me to save their souls or anything on that level, but just out of the what Swami calls the desire of joy to share and to expand. This has been so meaningful to me and to so many I know, there's a desire for joy to expand itself. And yet, of course, the world has not always been entirely congenial to these ideas. Let's just say that mainstream culture has a lot of different priorities other than Sri Ram, J Ram, JJ Ram. You know, it's not just not exactly what they're thinking. When I was very early on the path, I was reading, among other things, the Ramayana, the great epic of India about Lord Rama and Sita. And I had this 1,500-page version of that book by Valmiki. This would be like 1916, well, I met, it must have been 1967, 68. I lived in San Francisco. I lived out on Geary. I worked on Montgomery Street in the financial district just as a secretary. And I would ride the Geary Express bus, and I would read this story the whole time on the bus. And there's some really tense parts in there where Rama's wife, Sita, has been captured by the demons and she's been spirited away and she's being held captive in this pleasure garden and he's making very improper advances to her and she's holding out against this and Rama is frantically seeking everywhere for her. I mean, it's very, you know the end, of course, but still it doesn't matter. And I would sit on the crowded Geary bus during the rush hour reading about this. And I would see everyone else just going about their lives perfectly normally. Didn't they understand? Sita was in the hands of the demon. Would she be able to hold out? Would Rama find her? And they'd just be sitting there like this. And then, you know, Sita was found and Rama was so rejoicing. And I had this impulse on the bus. What if I started singing, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai 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 Ram. This was before the Hare Krishnas were actually doing that. I thought, would everybody just delightedly join in with me? Not likely, I thought. So I would just keep reading. You know, just living on very different planets. And I have wondered, you know, how this transformation that the masters speak of will come about. You know, Paramahansa Yogananda was a great avatar. His life eventually, according to scripture, according to his own statements, will have an influence over the whole world. When Jesus was born, he knew his life would have an influence over the whole world. It was very hard to see in the context in which he was just acting it out. And yet, over time, these avatars always come, and slowly by slowly, their message gets planted. And I've really wondered how the change would come. And now I've lived long enough to have seen, you know, some of the realities that I was part of at the beginning, you know, the whole movement of the 60s. And I think of the example of organic food as a simple one. You know, in the late 60s, when me and my lunatic friends were starting to assert that our whole food production system was really off, nobody took it seriously at all. And there's never been a point in which government first decided to say that was true. But what happened was consciousness shifted. And from the ground up, this movement came until now it's very common. You go into Safeway and you can buy organic foods. You know, it's just everywhere like this, because there's a shift in consciousness from the ground up. Well, in the new year, in the paper, they're talking about 2009, economically insecure. A psychologist is writing a self-help article for all those people who are so nervous. And then there's 8 points or 10 points. The last one is, I love it the way he phrased it, this would be a good time to develop an inner spiritual life. I think, yes, that's it. You know, this would be a good time to develop an inner spiritual life, because we're going to be dealing with, we may be dealing with, an all-pervasive insecurity. It's not going to be enough just every Sunday to go sit somewhere for an hour and have somebody tell you that maybe it's going to be all right. But, you know, a teaching that doesn't really necessarily know it's going to be all right. This would be a time to have an inner relationship with the power and the presence of Spirit. Now, the Gospel of John makes this extraordinary statement. In the beginning was the Word, and everything that was made of this Word. And there is no other reality but this Word. In all things that were made, we are one with the Word of God. Now, the Word of God does not mean the physical Bible. It'd be sort of hard to see us all made out of pieces of paper and bits of leather. It doesn't make any sense like that. But when we read in the Gita, and we read as we have from the self-realization side, we learn about the all-pervasive vibration of Om, which is this great sound that you hear. The elements of creation are sound and light. The Christian Bible says at the very beginning, I mean the Old Testament says, and the Lord said, let there be light, and there was light. And then again, when we go to the Gita, when we go to the Vedas, it talks about the manifestations of Spirit, of which light and sound are the building blocks. Then we have Master who comes to us and he says, meditate, look to the spiritual eye, see the light of the divine self. Meditate and listen inwardly and hear the great booming sound of Om. Merge into that sound. Now, what we usually think of, and this is the way the human mind tends to work, we tend to sort of see ourselves going about our little lives. You know, here I am, and I have all my little duties, and you all have all your little duties, and we're all so busy, aren't we, on our little telephones and our little emails and our little lives, and huff, puff, one more day, and then we finish one more day, and then huff, puff, we have another little day, and huff, puff, we have one after that, and it just goes on and on and on and on, doesn't it? And then we try to sort of bring into that something of the Spirit. We'll meditate, we'll have our chants, we'll listen to music, we'll listen to Swami speak. But the orientation we tend to have is we see ourselves first in this ego-identified way, and then we try to sort of reach up and bring a little of the Spirit into it. Well, one of the many practices of the 100% of things that Master has asked of us is he suggests that we memorize his poem, Samadhi. And the words that are on the wall here are phrases from that poem, and the whole poem is against the back wall. It's a long poem. And the images of it are extremely complex and a little bit beyond our normal experience. And samadhi is the state of a conscious oneness with the infinite spirit. And it's the state of God realization that is that defines our spiritual freedom. And master, it was very unusual. There's nothing else in spiritual literature in which a master actually writes of the actual perception he has in that state of God consciousness. It was a special gift, you might say, for this time, for this age, because we're moving into a new age and it's possible for us to think directly about those things. Many, many mystics have written indirectly and beautifully about the relationship and what they're experiencing, but this is a very explicit poem. Now, Master tells us to memorize that poem and to recite it every day. Well, this is a practice intermittently that I've done, and more recently it's come to the fore again, very strong in my spiritual experience. And yesterday, when we were having here sort of our closing long meditation day for this season, and I was reciting that poem inwardly, all of a sudden I could feel why it is that Master wants us to do that. Because we step into that reality, which is the reality which is our own destiny. Yes, it's true that Master has this consciousness at will and can just describe this state effortlessly, and we can only hear about it. But the power of his consciousness permeates those words. So they're more than just words. They're an actual conduit to the state of consciousness that he describes. That's what makes any artistic or literary effort scripture and not mere literature, is that it becomes a conduit to an infinite state of consciousness. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking of the phrase, I, the cosmic sea, watch the little ego floating in me. And that was when it occurred to me that it's really the little me who sort of peers over the horizon and hopes to get a glimpse of the cosmic sea. We think of ourselves first as small. But Master, having us recite that poem over and over again and drawing into our awareness that the infinite is first, and then from the infinite this tiny little thread has come down, this little tiny thing that calls itself whatever our name happens to be, and how different it is to be the cosmic sea watching the little ego floating than it is to be the little ego hoping to get a glimpse of the sea. You see the difference? But you see, that difference is everything. And from that feeling, I began to hear so many things that Swamiji has said over the years. Meditating as the cosmic sea, watching the little ego floating in me, I thought of the anxiety I might feel about whether this little thing is going to work out, and the stress I might feel about this little bit of creative work that I have to do, and this little wonder of knowing what the right thing to say is, and whether this person really likes me or not, and, you know, just all the, it's a long list, isn't it? That's just the beginning of mine. You know, you can all make your own. But just everything that interrupts our capacity to be in a perfect state of joy. From joy I came, in joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. Do we? Are we? Are we aware of that or no? But you see, everything else is just the thinnest, thinnest facade over that enormous power. And I have heard Swamiji so many times when he's trying to express the secret of his creativity. In his complete relaxation, for example, he talked about the fact that, when I was working on my book and I was struggling so much and was having so much difficulty with writer's block, and I was talking to Swamiji on the phone, and he said, I've never had it. He never had it. He said he's never had it. Because it's never, and this is the way he's often explained it, it's so sweet. He says he's never anxious about whether he can accomplish something, because it never occurs to him that he is the one accomplishing it. His thought form is always that, well, Master can do anything through me. God can do anything through me. The infinite creativity can express whatever is needed. And his thought form is not about the little I and how it's going to function. His thought is only about what needs to be done, and here I am willing to do it. A friend once who had a strong sense of a personal need to be artistic, and against Swami's advice, felt that that person felt they needed to leave Ananda and to go somewhere else because they needed to be able to write music and poetry and these things that they wanted to write. And he was trying to justify his feelings and saying to Swami, who's so creative, you know how it is. Sometimes you just feel you have to write a song like that. Swami said very calmly, no, I never feel that way. And the man was completely bewildered, but you've done all this work. And Swami said, I never think about I need to create something. I think about how a certain creation might be needed in order to serve people. And then if it will serve people, I ask God to help me to serve them. You see how different that is? But you see, then you're also standing back in this great ocean of spirit. What does the great ocean of spirit need to do to share itself with others, to uplift, to help, to bring joy? It's all about, well, one of the first principles of the Ananda Sangha is simply this. There is one all-pervasive reality, Satchit Ananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. And because we all emanate from that same ocean of spirit, we are bound together in bonds of mutual service. That's such a magnificent phrase. I've meditated a great deal on that, mutual service. It's interesting also because it's not just I am nothing and I must give everything. It's that we live in an interrelated universe, and we're all part of the same infinite ocean. And as part of that same infinite ocean, we give, we receive, we move, we're raised, we fall, but we never step out of that one ocean of spirit. I, the cosmic sea, watch the little ego floating in me. I profoundly and deeply would like all of us to unite in this thought for the coming year. I think it could be extremely powerful. I think it may also be very important. This is probably a good time to develop an inner spiritual life. This is probably a good time to redefine ourselves as part of this great beneficent universe. There's the song that Dambara sang for us this morning, Mother of Us All. Mother, all your children call you, knowing not it's you they call. Some through mists of their unknowing, bruised and hurting when they fall, turn away, and who would help them? You, the mother of us all. It's such a beautiful song, isn't it? And what it's really saying is, here we are in this world together, these little children, this image of Divine Mother that Master brought is an image of just saying that at the end of this whole story, I've been speaking very impersonally about the cosmic sea, but sometimes it's not so easy to relate to something as impersonal as that. But the cosmic sea, the Om vibration of which we are made, is this loving form of the Divine Mother. And that's really the place of refuge. But you see, we can't take that Divine Mother and try to draw her into this little universe. Oh, Mother, I'm going to stay here small and scared and selfish, and as soon as I get my strength back, I'm going to go out and try to get mine, or, you know, like this. It has to be that we step out of that little place and walk into the arms of that Mother and are willing to say, all right, Mother, it's just me and you, and you're in charge. That's the part. That's where our real security comes from. You know, at the end point, and this is what that psychologist is saying, this is a good time to have an inner spiritual life, because pretty much anything else you're going to rely upon may not come through for you. It may not be just a matter of the right resume and the right this and the right that and the right investments, whatever they might be at this particular time. You know, just so many things are uncertain. But the only certainty is going to be to transcend it in the understanding that I am just the little ego floating in this cosmic sea, and if I open the door to that infinite spirit and ride that wave holding my mother's hand, wherever it takes me will be exactly where I want to be.